Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, October 21st, 2010. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. Well, this week, Andy Sparks and I revisit kegging. Andy has the center spread story on kegging in the November issue of Brew Your Own magazine, and we talk about it over a tasty saison or two. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. And you can follow me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing, all one word. On Facebook, I am facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And our show page on Facebook is facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody clicking on the amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra. You'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we appreciate your support. We've also got associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And you can find our iPhone app on the iTunes Store. Just search for Basic Brewing. And you can find us on your BlackBerry in the BlackBerry podcast directory, too. I want to start off with a deep apology. Last week, I talked with the Brew Trawler guys, and I got Jeremiah's last name wrong. It's Dillingham, not Billingham. Sorry about that, Jeremiah. That's the dangers of relying on one's hearing for accuracy when one is in one's mid-40s, I'm afraid. So sorry about that, Jeremiah. Dillingham with a D. There's this from Jason somewhere out there. In the internet land, I've worked closely with Jeremiah and Matt over some over the past year on the Brew Trawler project and was excited to hear of the podcast segment. I was disappointed, however, that they neglected to mention the fermentation control aspect of the Brew Trawler called the Firm Trawler. I imagine they omitted it due to the focus of its use in the brewery context, which can be a rather extensive topic in and of itself. Jason says, the Firm Trawler is a great introduction to automation as it is rather simple and doesn't carry the controller brewed the beer, not you argument. In its simplest and most common application, it monitors the temperature of a fermentation chamber and turns on a cooling or heating source as needed to maintain a desired temperature. In addition, it can be used to monitor the internal temperatures of multiple fermenters. At the apex of its complexity, would be controlling heating and cooling sources dedicated to each fermenter. Adding the ability to log the collected data can be a very useful tool for the brewer. There are also some very interesting developments for this device as well, Jason says. For example, an in-system specific gravity probe to monitor fermentation progress. Talk about buried lead. That's very interesting. I'd love to hear more about that gravity probe. As with Sean Terrell, I'm assuming. I bet Sean would want to learn more about that, too. On another topic, Adri from the Netherlands writes this. I recently listened to your podcast about new Albanian gruits. I noticed that, like all English-speaking people do, you pronounce gruit, G-R-U-I-T, not the way it should be. Gruit is a Dutch word, as you probably know, for your information and for the listeners. By the way, I didn't know it was a Dutch word. I send you an MP3 file with the right pronunciation of the word G-R-U-I-T. Good luck. As you can hear, it's not pronounced as gruit or groot. I guess that if everybody knows what you're talking about, it doesn't matter what you call it. But just I wanted to let you know and the listeners know how it's originally pronounced. So here is Adri's pronunciation.
Gruit. Gruit.
Okay. let me try. Grout. Grout.
Gruit. Gruit.
Is that close? Adri, you'll have to let me know.
Grout.
Sounds like kraut almost.
Kraut.
All right. I may need more practice. I need practice and a squeegee for my mic. Thanks, Adri. Brett from Portland responds to the question about homegrown ingredients from last week's show. Brett says, Upright Brewing released their reggae junkie
Kraut
at the Oregon Brewers Fest, and all of the yarrow used was grown in their backyards. Nice. You know, we toured Upright for a Basic Brewing video episode. And if the beers we tasted then are any indication, I'm sure that the reggae
Kraut
was quite tasty. So thanks for that, Brett. Now, oh, my untrained tongue, so to speak. Now, if you look in the November issue of Brew Your Own magazine, you will see an article on the Basic Brewing Radio BYO collaborative experiment on Irish moss and other clarifiers. And if you participated in the experiment, you will see your name in print. And thanks again, everybody, for helping us out with that. And Chris Colby did a great job of writing that one up, so be sure to read that. And you can see pictures that I took of my fermenters during that process in the magazine. And you'll see an article by Andy Sparks of thehomebrewery.com on kegging. Andy is my homebrew store owner, got me into homebrewing, and I looked in the archives and saw that Andy and I first talked about kegging on October 20th, 2005. How wild is that? 5 years ago, almost to the day. So I figured it was time to revisit. Well, Andy Sparks, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Oh, I'm glad to be here, James. Great as always.
We are both featured in Brew Your Own magazine this time.
How about that?
How about that? You got pretty much, if not the cover story, you got the center, what do they call it? Center spread is what they call it. I was going to say center fold, but you're not... You're not the centerfold and Brew Your Own this time.
Well, this publishing stuff is a little new to me. This is my second article. It's pretty neat. The thing is, it's all the whole issue is about kegging, really. So mine is part of a group effort, I guess. But it looks like it's a good issue.
Yeah, but yours is pretty much the kind of the flagship article that the others are kind of sidebars off of, because you talk about how to get into kegging, you know, how the whole thing works, just for an overview. And I want to talk about that. But first of all, you want to talk about this beer that we're sipping?
Well, sure. Basically, a while back, I stole an idea from a Basic Brewing episode about doing this Iron Brewer contest. So I proposed that to our club, our local club. And we've been lately doing this kind of Iron Brewer contest where I throw out an ingredient and they brew that ingredient and try to kind of win. It's just really, you know, who can win that day, that month. Anyway, the last ingredient, another complete ripoff of their contest, was the oatmeal cookie idea. And I had a saison that I had made earlier in the year that turned out pretty good, and it had a little bit of toasted oats in it. And I thought, I'll just switch out the toasted oats for this some oatmeal cookie. So this is my iced oatmeal cookie saison, and it's turned out pretty good, really.
Yeah, I think it's wonderful. I wouldn't have picked out iced oatmeal cookies in there, but it's way good. Where did you put the cookies?
Well, I think it's probably a good thing that you don't notice the cookies in there too much. You know, it really tastes, you know, a lot like a traditional saison. It doesn't have a lot of, you know, sweet kind of cookie flavor, that icing flavor that you might perceive. Basically what it is, I just, right before I closed the mash tun after mashing in, I just put the cookies right in the top of the mash tun. The first time I stirred it in, you know, 15 minutes in to just kind of check temperature and everything, they were completely dissolved and mixed right in and never saw them again. But just kind of a fun idea. It's just another little bit of fermentable stuff to toss in there, and now I can say it's got oatmeal cookies in it.
And it is way tasty. But let's talk about kegging, because from a fellow kegger, you know, I...
Finally, James, joined the group of keggers.
Yeah, I know. You've been after me for years and years. And Steve and I are redoing the extract DVD, and we're adding partial mashing on it, and we're doing bottling, and we're also doing kegging. And I said, well, I guess I have to do it. You know, I really have to gain some experience. If I'm going to speak with confidence about this process, I'm going to have to do it. So I bought a kegging setup. I bought a kegerator. And I have to admit, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, it is nice going from doing all those bottles. I mean, there's a special place for bottles and there's a good time for bottling. But that time when you were the first time, you get your keg all cleaned up and you put your beer in there and it's just one drain it from the you know, your secondary into your keg and close that lid up. And the next day you're like, ooh, I'm just days away from a frosty glass of beer. It's really, it's quite nice. And that's a lot of what we went into in the article is, kind of the pros and the cons, you know, which you might not think about when you, take off into this venture of kegging.
I think that I'm always going to be a bottler, or I'm always going to bottle beers, because kegging is so easy to do and so easy to drink, that there are certain beers like, I'm planning on doing another remake of the Zombie Belgian, which is a big old beer, and you know, for my own safety, I don't want that as easily accessible as being on tap, you know, up in the studio. So, and I want to be able to save that for a long period of time and kind of age it. And if I were doing that on a keg, that would mean that I would have a keg that was occupied by that beer. And that's also a beer that I'd like to bring over here and share with you and things like that. And that's where kegging is a little more difficult.
Well, that's exactly right. You know, you're going to always have to balance, you know, the beer that you're brewing and what you want from that beer and whether you want to keg it or not. There's certain times when you're going to, you know, want a bottle of beer, you know, because it's going to be a beer that you need to have portable. But you can always put beer into bottles that you've kegged. So there are options for that. I think there's not a bit in the magazine about counter pressure bottle fillers that allow you to do that. And there's some easy ways of doing that as well. But there certainly are times when you're going to want that special beer or one that you're going to age for a long time to put in a bottle. Now, there are, you know, like for me, I actually have a little capacity. So I can occasionally, you know, put a big beer up for a while and let it sit in a keg, which is also kind of nice because then it ages as one vessel. So you have one big keg of something, like I'm doing a Berliner Weiss now, which is something that I want to be able to age for 6 months or so. And I want to be able to do that all as one thing. So I'm going to just do that in the keg and then probably drink it on draft as well.
So you have the magic beer fridge and a kegerator in the living room. So you have, like you said, you do have some capacity to have more than one beer on tap and to be able to set some beers back in the keg. That's one consideration that you've got to think about when you're going into kegging is that you are going to have some sort of refrigeration unit to store your beer. So it takes an investment in not only the kegging equipment, but it also takes an investment in the refrigeration equipment and an investment in the space to put all that stuff.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I've talked to people about kegging a lot, and occasionally I'll get people that describe trying to do it without having some sort of refrigerator or anything like that, a kegerator or something like that. It makes it not really difficult. You really want to be able to put your beer under refrigeration and have it, you know, at serving temperature so that it's ready at all times, whether you're going to be carbonating it, whether you're serving it. Either way, beer is very fragile. You know, you don't really want to leave it sitting around at room temperature. Certainly, you know, naturally carbonating bottles. That's we do that all the time. But typically, once I get a beer all carbonated and ready to go, I leave it in the refrigerator in the kegging system. The other thing you got to think about is the energy that this is going to use. You know, you're going to have to put it, you know what, in a refrigerator, maybe in the garage. Garages are warm, so you got to kind of think about all those things. But I would have to say, once you decide to go ahead and get a draft set up whether it's a kegerator or some sort of freezer, a converted freezer or refrigerator, there's probably just no looking back. The ability to have a couple beers on draft at any time so you can go get yourself another half glass of beer. it's really, really nice.
Yeah, my first beer that I put on the system was the leftover hops pale ale with a bunch of American hops at the end of the boil, and it is really nice on the coming off the draft. It's nice, and the body of it is really nice. The temperature is always good. It is a wonderful thing. And I'm not sure that it would have been interesting to bottle half of it and keg half of it to see what the character, you know, what character changed between those two half batches. But it's just a wonderful thing. And I'm going to be sad when it's gone. But on the other hand, I'll be happy because I'll have an empty keg to fill. Mm. And I've got plans for the next one. So, let's start with the very basics, like you did in the article. If you are a new home brewer, and we talked about this years ago, but mm-hmm. some things might have changed between now and then. I think most things are basically the same, but some things may have developed over time. If you are a new home brewer or you're going to go new into kegging, what do you got to buy? What's the bare minimum that you've got to buy to get into kegging?
Okay, well, to start with, you're going to need a keg. We'll kind of go over the kegs, I think, last, but just want to kind of, first thing, you'll need a keg. That's going to be a ball lock or a pin lock keg. You'll also need a gauge setup. There's going to be two different styles of gauges. There's a single gauge and a double gauge. The double gauge shows both high pressure and low pressure in your tank. You'll also need a tank. You'll also need the hoses to go from the tank to the keg, and then a hose that goes from the keg to your Cobra tap or serving tap. You'll need a tap. Typically, in a beginner setup, you'll get what we call a little plastic picnic tap or a Cobra tap. And then you'll need the two quick disconnects that go on top of the keg. So one is going to be for the gas side of things and one will be for the liquid side of things. Typically, we see them and they're either going to be gray and black. The black one is for beer. That would be go on the out side. Normally a keg is going to have a label on it somewhere that shows which one is the out and the in. And then the gray one is the gas one. Gray is for gas, and that one usually goes on the inside of the keg. So basically, we talked about the fact that there's two different kinds of kegs. There's a ball lock and pin lock. Basically, these kegs are used to be used to hold soda syrup in. Quite a few years ago, they're very rarely used anymore. But the two big soda companies in America, pretty much. They each didn't want their restaurant vendors or the restaurant companies to switch between companies, and they didn't want them to be able to just decide one day they'd go with one versus the other, so they made the two systems, the two syrup containers, incompatible with each other. So one has these pins sticking out from around the post. Those would be the pin lock style. One pin post has three pins on it, and the other post has two pins. The other, which was that, and those were basically Coke canisters, and then Pepsi basically did what we called ball lock. Those are more similar to a quick disconnect that you find on a garden hose. It uses ball bearings to create this little lock mechanism. So with those, they just have kind of some grooves on the post, and then the quick disconnects kind of grab on, like I said, with some ball bearings.
So if you're looking into kegging, you've got to make that decision up front, right, on whether you're going to be a pin lock guy or whether you're going to be a ball lock guy or whether you're going to have to, you're setting up your system to have some sort of quick disconnects or something to go back and forth between the two, because those connectors are not interchangeable.
That's true. The truth is everybody pretty much over the last few years has really kind of tended to prefer the ball lock ones, the Pepsi style ones. So those are basically starting to run out. You can still get new ones. They still make new ones, but those are very expensive. So the used market on the ball lock Pepsi kegs is drying up, so the prices are going up on those. Whereas the Penlock ones, which have all long been out of favor, are still available and still fairly inexpensive. So, you know, you got to kind of weigh a lot of different stuff here. It may behoove you to go ahead and go Penlock, or to get some of both and, you know, switch them out as you need them. The truth is you can get some special new adapters that you can actually remove the Penlock posts from the kegs, switch them out with these ball lock, and kind of make them into ball lock ones. The ones that I've seen are made of aluminum, so if you push caustic through or beer line cleaner through your kegs to clean them, that can be corrosive on those. But if you're just a little careful, you'd probably be fine with those. So that is one option.
So once you've chosen which one that you're going to get, you're probably, if you're going to start off, going to get a used keg. Now, what are you going to look at? I mean, when you go to your homebrew store, is it necessary that they be under pressure? I mean, you can pull the pressure release valve on the top of the keg, and if you hear, you know that it's got that it can hold pressure, but that's not necessarily what you need, right?
Well, that's correct. Yeah. If I was going into a store to get a new keg, the first thing I would do is check to see if it's under pressure. If it's not under pressure, I'd ask them if they could put it under pressure for me. Mm-hmm. Usually they're going to be pretty cool about that sort of stuff because they want you to have a good keg and make good beer and be satisfied with the product. So what I would do is first of all, check to see if it holds pressure. If it holds pressure, that's not necessarily a guarantee. But if they've been sitting for a long time under pressure and still hold pressure, that's a pretty good indication that they don't leak.
And we need them to hold pressure. Why?
Well, you know, eventually we're going to put our beer in there and try to pressurize under CO2, and they won't carbonate if they can't hold pressure. The other thing is you can a small leak under a lid that is hard to detect sometimes. But you can, over the course of a couple of days, drain a whole tank away, and you just don't even realize it. So, you know, if you get the opportunity, they'll probably, you know, if it's holding pressure, good idea. Look for dents. That's the big thing. I look for around the top of the lid. I look for dents around there, and I look for on the posts to see if there's any chips or dents on the post to make them where they wouldn't fit snugly inside their you know, adapter that you're going to use, your quick disconnect. Those are kind of your really fault points. The lid, where it connects, and then the poppets, whether they seal, and then the O-rings. So, you know, we should probably bring up the fact that there's a lot of different kind of ideas of what it means to have a keg reconditioned. And I did mention this in the article. I bought a few kegs over the years from people, and sometimes it simply means that they ship you the keg.
It doesn't have soda syrup in it.
Actually, we've received several that have soda syrup in them. And who knows how long that soda syrup's been sitting in there. But then sometimes we've received kegs that are reconditioned and are actually basically have all new seals and they're really good to go. Sometimes they're just basically rinsed out and pressure tested. So like in the article, I recommend, you know, getting your keg and examining all those, you know, the rubber seals, the big one around the top. There's a big black one that fits around the top that helps seal the top. And then there's several other O-rings. There's two that you can see on the outside that are on top of on these posts. Then there'll be two up underneath there that you'll also want to check out. So those are the, you know, kind of rubber parts. If the place where you're getting them from actually got real reconditioned kegs, you might not need to replace them. They may be all new. If not, it doesn't hurt. It's only probably $4 or $5 to get all that stuff.
And if they hold the pressure, that's a good thing, but they still might carry a little bit of essence of Pepsi, right? Or Coke or something like that.
Well, that's for sure. You know, there's certain soda pops that seem to impregnate the rubber parts worse than others. You know, there's a certain pepper one, and there's something we drink in the United States called root beer that permeates the seals to the point where they pretty much have to be thrown away.
Oh, great! I've got my second keg. I've got root beer for my son in it, so well, I'm going to come see you again. I think when that runs out.
Yeah, well, maybe you just dedicate that to making root beer and soda pop from.
So you talk about the posts in the top. You take those off. I just used one of those RoboGrip things, wrenches.
Excellent.
And I was able to get around the special, connector thing on top of the posts to unscrew those posts and then get to the dip tubes underneath. Talk about those.
Right. Once you unscrew the posts, and you know, just a quick point that when you came and looked at your kegs, you noticed that the posts were all attached with kind of different, a different kind of nut or a different way to connect it. So it's not always going to be easy to just grab it with a normal wrench. So like you said, the RoboGrip is great, or you can use a towel and a pair of pliers if you can't get it any other way. You get it loosened up and get it unscrewed. But once you get those things unscrewed, pull them off. Below those are going to be the dip tubes. The liquid side is going to be a long dip tube. It's going to go all the way down to the bottom. Sometimes you kind of need to tease it out of the hole, kind of twist it back and forth to get it all the way up and out of the hole. And once you do that, you want to back the little, there's a little rubber O-ring that's kind of all the way up at the flared top of that post. Kind of roll that back down, check it to make sure it's not square. It should be round and still hold its round shape, but I mean, sometimes they've been squeezed in there for 10 years and so they've lost their ability to be flexible. So if that's the case, take them off, remove them, put some new ones on. The gas side is only going to be about an inch long. It's kind of made the same way, flared at the top, has an O-ring underneath it. Same sort of deal. Check it to make sure that it's not kind of gotten hard and inflexible. Take it off, replace it if it is, and then slide those guys back down in there. You want to kind of really be careful as you're taking these things apart to get the pieces back together. I mentioned this in the article, but I've heard some horror stories about this, of people basically getting two or three kegs at once and disassembling all the pieces and parts and throwing them into a bucket of sanitizer or soapy water. And then as they try to put them back together, they realize that the posts are not the same, that the outpost and the inpost are not the same, and the little pieces just don't quite fit together the same way. So I kind of always do it one keg at a time and kind of be a little methodical about it. You shouldn't be intimidated by it, but just understand that you don't want to take a bunch of kegs apart and throw them in a bucket all at once, because you got a jigsaw puzzle to put back together after that.
Now, Brett, right again from Twitter, Brett from Madison, Wisconsin, says, do you always recommend replacing the seals and poppets on reconditioned Cornies when you buy them?
Well, like I was saying, sometimes...
And I guess we should define what a poppet is.
Ah, right. Okay, so on the posts, let's get to that really quick. On the posts, as you pull these things off, in the center is the little pin, or what we call the poppet. And it's the part that it's the little valve. It's got a little spring that pops up and down, and it depresses when you put the quick disconnect on it, and it allows the beer to flow. As I said before, sometimes your keg will come from somebody that's fairly reputable as far as the ability to, or is what they call, when they describe their kegs as reconditioned. Sometimes they're really well done, and they actually do replace lots of the parts. So I always recommend kind of checking it out and deciding how badly worn the parts are and stuff. If the keg looks pretty beat up, you're probably better off replacing some of these parts. These are going to be cheap little parts that once you get done will last you a lifetime. You know, you got to figure these soda kegs were used by the soda companies and probably went through, you know, 10, 20 cycles, 30 cycles a year. You know, most of us are only going to put it through 4, 5, 6 cycles a year, and that's brewing pretty aggressively. So, always check them out. You know, I probably assume the worst, but, you know, the truth is, you know, they may be pretty good. And the other thing, you know, I kind of want to point out is that your homebrew shop isn't necessarily the reconditioner. They just are buying kegs and trying to get them for the best price for their customers. And so they get sometimes stuck with kegs that are not as nice as they can be sometimes. And sometimes they get these really awesome kegs that people obviously spend a lot of time and effort to get into top shape. So, but then they got to get them, you know, they got to move them. So, yeah, go check them out. And you know, make your best judgment as far as whether you need to replace the rubber parts and seals.
And the poppets are fairly easy to get out. At least on mine, they were. Once you get that post off and the dip tube taken off, you just take some sort of tool and press down on the poppet, and it will pop right out of there. And then you can take a look at it and see if it's dirty or see if it needs to be replaced. It's fairly easy to do once you get those. The hardest part I found was getting the posts off. But with that, like I say, with the RoboGrip thing, it was a fairly easy thing to do. So then you got to make sure your keg is clean, and you got to make sure that your keg is sanitized, right?
That's right. You know, usually, you know, we're talking about this. The very first time you get your keg, you definitely want to completely strip it all the way down and check all these parts out thoroughly. You know, sometimes, you know, I don't necessarily strip a keg in between two batches of beer, especially if they're going to be similar styles of beer. I still wash them thoroughly and clean them, but I don't necessarily break the thing down and scrub out the poppets with a toothbrush and all that stuff. The first time, yeah, I do that. But the trick is to completely flush the keg with nice hot soapy water. You can use PBW. That's something that I use. You can also use kind of, you know, like automatic dish detergent. You know, you can use kind of that. But what you want to do is you want to get them good and soapy. Push that stuff through. So what I usually do is mix up a nice warm batch of this kind of either PBW or, you know, dish detergent or something, and put it down in there, put the lid on, and then I pressurize the keg and I'll push it through the system, and I'll push it out of a serving tap, and I'll let it stand for a few minutes, and then I'll push some more out. And I do that until it's either all gone or I decide I'm tired of doing that. But, you know, just give it a good thorough clean, and you want to make sure that flows through the system. Then I take it out, rinse it thoroughly, shake it and rinse it a couple times. Then I do the same with a rinse water. One nice thing to do is to finish up with an acid-based sanitizer, like a Star San or a Sandy Clean, which will neutralize any of the chemicals that are in there if they're base chemicals like PBW, and end up with basically packing your lines with basically a sanitizer.
Now, and one thing that you have that is handy is you have one of these foaming sprayers that you have filled with Star San at all times, so that, say, for instance, you get finished reassembling your keg after you've replaced the gaskets, you want to make sure that your seals still work. So you can pressurize it with CO2, and then you showed me how to spritz with the foaming sanitizer on all the connectors and all the lid, and you see if you see any bubbles, and you get in a quiet place, and you see if you can hear any hissing, so that you can make sure that that thing is still functional, because you know, you've taken it apart, you've put it back together again. So now we've got it all clean, and we've got it sanitized, and we know that it's good to go. So all we do now is just fill it full of good beer, right?
Beer.
Sorry, I distracted you.
Oh, yeah, well, that's basically all we got to do. There's a couple other things we do need to do. So now we've got our keg all sanitized and cleaned up. What we want to do is we want to probably flush it with CO2 before we fill the keg with our nice clear beer that's sitting in our secondary somewhere. You know, we're going to feel a lot more comfortable when we hear splashing in the bottom of the keg as we transfer it in, if we know that before we started we filled it the keg with CO2, which is pretty easy to do if you push the last of the sanitizer out of the keg with CO2.
Yeah.
When you open the lid, it'll look kind of smoky inside, steamy inside, and that's that CO2. Don't take a big sniff. It'll burn.
And don't stick your head in there for an extended period of time.
Yeah.
Or put any small animals in there.
You won't be able to. So take the lid off. Usually I want to get my beer nice and cold before I start this procedure. But it's not absolutely necessary. Go ahead and transfer your beer into the keg, and then put the lid on. If the beer's warm, you're going to want to now move it into the fridge. I always top it off with a little CO2 and vent the lid a couple times, and that just basically makes sure that any air that kind of got in there while I was doing this is also purged out, so that you're feeling pretty good about the fact that there's only CO2 in there with your beer. So if it's not cold, go ahead and move your newly kegged beer up into your refrigerator and let it sit. Let it sit overnight, get it good and cold. At this point, we can now start working on making it carbonated.
Because cold liquids hold more CO2 or more carbonation than warm liquids do.
That's exactly right. It would be a real struggle to push CO2 into warm beer. Warm beer, as you probably know, a can of a warm beer usually sprays when you open it, and it's because the CO2 does not want to be in solution at that point. It really wants to be out of solution. Liquid can only absorb so much at a certain temperature, and the colder it is, the more it can absorb. So what we want to do is we want to get it down to serving temperature. We want to get it nice and cold, and then we can start to push the CO2 into it. Now, we've got a couple different ways we can go on that, and there's kind of two different schools of thought. There's the crank and shake method, and then there's the sit and wait method. There's also another method.
and Ashton, Mr. Wizard, covered this in his column, if you're looking through the magazine. Let's start with the crank and shake, which after the first time we talked about this, I got a couple of emails from sort of purists, I guess I'd say, that kind of frown on the crank and shake method.
That's for sure. There's, like I said, there's two schools of thought on this. And this is the artificial carbonation method, these two methods. The crank and shake method, you know, it works pretty well. And for most homebrewers, especially if this is your first keg, first or second keg of beer, you probably are not going to be able to wait a week or so to push the CO2 in under normal pressure and have it stabilize and carbonate. Most of us can't. I can't do it.
I couldn't.
So, and I figure, you know, as long as you don't tell anybody and they can't tell. But the crank and shake method is basically... what you're going to do is you're going to dissolve CO2 into your beer pretty much as fast as you can do it. So what you'll do is you'll get your beer nice and cold, and you'll hook it up to your CO2 pressure, and then you turn the CO2 pressure up. You know, I don't usually push it up much more than, about 20 pounds, 22, 25 pounds, something like that. It doesn't have to be cranked to the sky, and that's a lot of pressure, really, when you're dealing with this sort of stuff. But then you basically start rocking the keg back and forth, and you'll start to hear the regulator hiss as the CO2 dissolves into the beer, and allows more CO2 to flow into solution. So, just keep shaking. You'll kind of get tired. You'll stop shaking for a minute. The hissing will kind of quiet down and stop. You'll shake it some more. It'll start hissing again. Pretty much what I find is about when I get really tired of shaking the keg is about the right amount of shaking. 10 minutes or so of periodic shaking.
Then you have to make sure that you remember to bring your serving pressure back down to 10 to 12 pounds, however it works on your system, before you put the beer back in the fridge, right?
Are you speaking from experience?
Not yet, but I thought about this.
No, that's very true. Basically, what you're going to want to do is you want to shake this thing really good, get this thing as much CO2 in. Then I disconnect the keg, park it in the fridge, and usually leave it overnight. This allows the CO2 to kind of get into equilibrium with the beer. It'll stabilize at a pressure more close to normal serving pressure. At this point, dial your temperature down, hook everything back up, and give it a test. See how the beer is. Is it too fizzy? Well, you're going to have to work on that. Hopefully, we creep up on it, and it's going to be about where you want it, or still, you know, needs a touch more, in which case you can hook it up and shake it some more. You can start to do what the purists, even though we're artificially carbonating our beer, what the purists would say, which is just hook it up at serving pressure and leave it. And eventually it will basically stabilize at a more of an accurate carbonation level. The truth is the purists would say what you should do is take the temperature of the beer, look up how many volumes of CO2 you want for that recipe, and then look at a chart, because there are some charts that show this, and it'll show you exactly what pressure to set it at, and you can set it at that pressure, hold the beer at that temperature, at that pressure for, you know, and it will equal 2.3 volumes of CO2 or 1.8 volumes of CO2, so that you can get a very, if you're trying to make an English bitter that has very low volumes of CO2, you can do that by doing this, you know, and it takes a little more effort, or you can shake it and do this stuff. Now, if you have several beers set up together, one of the things you got to realize is that if you have these things chained together in your CO2 system and they can flow freely between the two beers, they will all stabilize at the current current serving temperature, unless you have some sort of backflow preventer set up to keep it from doing that.
Now, for the set and wait method, how long do you have to wait until the beer equalizes?
Well, that's kind of the trick, is depending on how many volumes of CO2 you want in the beer and how fast, you know, it's going to probably take 4 or 5 days to a week. Mm. But on the other hand, if you have beer on tap already and you're bringing your beer into your system, it's probably the optimum way, is to basically just set your beer in your kegging system, hook it up to the tap, don't drink that one for a week, and within a week it's going to be ready to go, and
So there's a third way.
Okay, so the third way, and this really probably we should refer to, it would be the purest method. So this would be natural carbonation. This is the same thing that we do when we homebrew and put our beer in bottles and prime the beer. When you do this, you're going to want to adjust your priming level just a little bit. It takes less priming sugar to prime an entire keg. I think it's closer to, I'm winging it here, I want to say a half a cup to a third of a cup, whereas normally we use a half a cup to four-fifths of a cup, something like that.
So look up priming sugar calculators on the internet.
For sure.
And some of the ones that I've seen ask whether you're doing it in the bottle or in the keg.
Right, so. And it should, because it makes a difference. So the other thing to remember if you're going to do natural carbonation with a kegging system is that most people will go ahead and shave off probably a half inch of the bottom dip tube. This allows the a little yeast sediment to build up on the bottom, and you won't draw that up so much when you start to serve it. Other people argue that just go ahead and let the sediment occur on the bottom, and the first couple glasses will be cloudy and have it full of yeast, but then pretty quickly you'll pull all the yeast off the bottom of the keg. So
there is there's another way that's kind of a compromise between the crank and shake and the set and wait, which is kind of what I wound up doing, because I didn't know how long to shake, and I didn't want to overshoot it. So instead of doing your recommended 10 minutes, I just did 5 and figured I'd got a head start on the carbonation, and I just stuck it in the fridge. And it's great. So, you know, that's one thing. One thing is, once you get your own system, you can start playing with these things and figure out your own way, you know, to make yourself happy.
Yeah, you'll get a feel for it for sure.
And if people complain about your carbonation methods, they don't have to drink your beer.
There you go.
No, whatever makes you happy is the way to go, and whatever makes good beer. Now, John down in Adelaide, South Australia, says any tips for using nitrogen mixes for Guinness style stouts? We talked about CO2, but we haven't talked about nitrogen.
That's right. Well, there's a couple different ways to go on that. You can invest in a gauge setup and get a separate nitrogen tank, and then do do the where you blend the gases together. You can also go, and I'm not sure how it is because this is an international show here. I don't know how it is everywhere, but I know that in America you can get something called beer gas, which is a blend of CO2 and nitrogen that you can use with a regulator setup. And that way you can kind of get the same effect with a, with one tank. I don't personally do that. I haven't invested in that kind of setup. So it's not been one of those things that I've really looked into too much. The truth is you can really kind of stretch, kind of invest a lot of money in some of this stuff, especially as you start to get the special draft taps and that sort of stuff if you get a kegerator. So you can really kind of go off the deep end with how much you want to, what detail and everything you want to put into it.
Now, what if is there a way to use a properly acquired commercial keg for your homebrew? Now, this is a tricky question because keg theft is a serious problem for commercial breweries. Should we even talk about this? Because I don't want to encourage people to go out there and not return their keg that they've paid a deposit on. And even though they have paid a deposit, it's just a fraction of the cost of that keg, right? So if you can get your hands on a retired commercial keg, is there a way that you can use it in your system?
There sure is, and you're right. This whole keg theft is really a problem for the brewers, but there are ways to get legally acquired kegs, and it certainly is possible. There's a company that sells something called a keg man kit, and it's actually made so that you can pull the spears out of kegs. There's a process for doing that. Kegs are usually under pressure. Be very careful. But you can pull the cores out of those, and then there's kind of a snap ring that replaces the original safety lock or anti-tampering mechanism that they put in there. And you can use these to reseal kegs, and I actually have a couple kegs like that I do. And that's how I put beer into regular Sankey kegs. But the nice thing about that is that a lot of times your kegerators are set up to take Sankey kegs. And 15.5 gallons of beer is a nice size.
So you're not limited to the corny kegs. But again, please don't steal kegs from, acquire them under the proper methods, because I mean that's part of higher beer cost is stolen kegs, and I think most of the time when people steal them, they steal them for scrap and not for making kegels out of them or reusing them as kegs. But anyway, I just wanted to inquire about that just in case. Is there anything else that we should be talking about that we haven't yet?
Yeah, probably the one thing that we haven't really kind of talked about, and that's probably the biggest problem. I know it's the biggest problem that I see with people that have kegerators that buy commercial kegs, like, kegs of Budweiser or whatever, in their house, and they just don't clean their kegerators correctly or at all. To some degree, there's a little bit of this, in the homebrew community, but it's a little easier there in that homebrewers can actually disassemble their keg, and they routinely do that, and they can flush their lines, they can fill their keg with sanitizer and push it through their lines. Whereas, for somebody that has a kind of a typical kegerator setup with Sankey kegs, they can't do that so easily. They have to have some other way to push sanitizer and cleaner through their lines. So that's the ticket is make sure that your beer lines are flushed and cleaned in between uses. And you should use something that's made for it, like a beer line cleaner or PBW or something that's really meant to eat that stuff out of the lines, because it's surprising how easy it is to disconnect your tap line from a keg and then set it aside, and then you forget it a couple weeks, and the grunge that builds up in there won't flush out with a quick rinse. It really needs to be gotten with a chemical. So I advocate, you know, using something that's made, purpose-built for this process.
And my kegerator is a commercial kegerator because I have limited space, and I basically replaced a dorm fridge up in the studio with this kegerator. But you brought the point because you've got one as well, but it's got this tower that sits above the refrigerator unit. And so most of the time, the beer that's in the lines in that tower is not going to be anywhere near as cold as the beer that is in the kegerator itself, and that can cause a couple of issues, right?
That's right. You know, there's a couple different ways that they build these tower systems, and there's some kind of elaborate ways they can kind of counteract this. But the truth is the tower doesn't really have, most of the time, doesn't have any way to keep it cold. And cold wants to sink. It doesn't want to rise. So you're typically going to get the warmest air is going to go all the way to the top and basically collect up into that tower. And so if you have beer in a kegerator like that, and you don't drink beer for a day or two, you know, hard to believe, but now you've got basically beer that has sat up in the top of that thing up, you know, around the taps for 2-3 days at room temperature. And, that's not good for beer. And what'll happen is, like we talked about, the pressure, you know, as it warms up, the CO2 will want to come out of pressure. You'll create this pocket of CO2 up in the top of the head in that tower. And when you go to pour that first beer, what you'll get is a big blast of CO2 and a bunch of foam. And you pretty much are going to have to pour out almost, half a glass or a glass of beer before you can kind of get the line up into the tower cool again, and it'll start to pour without foam and nicely. So that's one of the frustrations about that. They do make systems where they can have a little fan, like a computer fan, that'll blow air up into the tower, to kind of keep the tower cold. That can help. But that is one of those drawbacks about those kind of towers.
Whereas if you had your own keg in your own refrigerator with like a picnic tap, that line will stay, the whole line will stay cold. Or if you make your own kegerator out of a refrigerator with a tap on the door, the line leading to that tap is going to be cold. So there's an advantage to making your own.
That's right. And, you know, there's lots of cool information on the internet and in past articles and brew your own about how to build a kegerator and the different ways to go, whether you go with a chest freezer and then put a collar on it, or you get an upright freezer and put the things through the door, or you know, whatever. There's so many ways to go. It's really pretty neat kind of part of the hobby.
Awesome. Well, it's been fun, and I can't wait till my next beer on tap.
Me either, James.
Thanks, Andy.
Thanks, James.
Thanks again to Andy. That cookie saison was indeed tasty. If you click on the BYO banner on basicbrewing.com, you can get a free copy of Brew Your Own magazine. And if you decide to subscribe after reading that, and who wouldn't, frankly, you'll be helping to support this show. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com. Or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Check out our homebrewing DVDs, Introduction to Extract Homebrewing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. We've got combo deals to save you a couple of bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Sharks Security VIP Sella IR SCNC 267W Wi-Fi Wireless IP Network Camera with built-in micro SD DVR and infrared night vision. And the potty book for boys. Thanks again, everybody. The potty book is just a target that you put on the back of the toy. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we greatly appreciate your support, as well as those who've clicked on the associate links for the American Homebrewers Association and BYO, too. That's all. Until next time, I'm off to have a refreshing... Until then, Thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.